This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
You are tuned in live with The People Speak on DBS Radio Network. Today is August 25th. I am Sophia Ray, your hostess for this week. Join us every Tuesday night, 8 p.m. Central Time at bbsradio.com on Station 2. The People Speak encourages audience participation during the show by calling in questions or comments toll-free in Canada and in the U.S. at 1-888-429-5471. And again, that is 1-888-429-5471. A corporate governance of superimposed egos have been putting millions at risk through careless and reckless genetic engineering. Despite the hazardous outcomes and side effects, these products are made available to the global public without warning or labeling the dangerous side effects. Tonight's guest, Mr. Stephen Drucker, a public interest attorney, brought forth a lawsuit against the FDA for the disclosure of files that report in detail the risks that genetic engineering imposes on the environment and all life forms. Mr. Drucker tells an astounding story of what just may be one of, if not the biggest fraud in scientific history. In his well-written book, Altered Genes and Twisted Truth, the venture to genetically engineer our food has subverted science, corrupted government, and systematically deceived the public. It is a great pleasure and honor to welcome you on The People Speak, Mr. Stephen Drucker. Thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're very, very welcome. Let's begin. How did you learn about the genetically engineered foods, and how did that come about?
Well, I began learning, and unfortunately, most Americans were not learning back then. This was in early 1996. I learned that there was a massive venture afoot to restructure the genetic core of the world's food supply. It had been totally under my radar till then, and I was surprised. And because I'd been interested in food safety for years, and I was surprised. I thought, if I didn't know about it yet, then most people probably didn't, and that was correct. I wanted to start learning the facts, and very quickly it became clear that there was a great gap between the promotional claims, and I think we could call it promotional hype, being put out not only by the industry, but by the scientific proponents of these foods, and the realities, and that there was good reason, good scientific reason, to view the products of genetic engineering with a cautious eye. And I was particularly concerned about the FDA's policy, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, because it had made a blanket presumption that these foods were going to be safe, except in rare cases where there was a transfer of a known allergen or a known toxin, and of course nobody was planning on doing that. So essentially they had given a blanket presumption, a green light to all these foods to come on the market without the requirement of one iota of safety testing, and of course without even the requirement that they be labeled. In the U.S., anyway, and that's still the situation in Canada. There's no labeling there either, although there is some requirement for some safety testing. But even in Canada, that's extremely superficial. But here in the United States, no regulation at all, although they purport to be regulating, but no regulation. So being a lawyer, I became concerned. The FDA's policy struck me as being quite irresponsible, to say the least, if not illegal, and it turned out it is illegal. I learned that as I continued my research. And I thought that there should be a lawsuit brought against the FDA to overturn its policy and give Americans the protections of safety testing and labeling that the law required. And that's how it all began.
What was your sole inspiration for writing your book?
Well, I hadn't planned on writing a book, for I was involved in this endeavor to bring genetic engineering under rational regulation, rational science-based regulation, for many years before I began to write a book. People have been urging me for years to write one, and my response would be, books take a long time, and I shouldn't have to write one, because the information that I have at hand, information pried out of the FDA files and other information, is more than sufficient to end this, and it would have been had the mainstream American media reported it fairly, but they've shut it down. The mainstream, there's an entire chapter in my book about the malfunction of the mainstream American media. Yeah, the subtitle is Pliant Accomplices in Cover-Up and I believe Fraud or Deception. And they have been. The chapter documents how the mainstream media have basically been pliant accomplices in the cover-up that has been affected by the FDA and mainstream scientific institutions, cover-up of anything unpleasant about genetically engineered food, and participating really in the deceptions and the way they report it. So what should have, the evidence that could have easily, had it been disseminated and fairly reported, would have easily stopped this venture years ago, back in 1999 when I released it at a well-publicized, well-attended press conference in Washington, D.C., did not, because the media would not report it. And eventually, I realized I would have to write a book because that vital information was not getting out there. And the propaganda mill was churning out the disinformation at an ever-increasing rate. So that really was my inspiration for writing it, that there was a pressing need to get these facts accessible in a way that would be a scientifically solid format for experts, but also in a way that would be a compelling story that the average intelligent non-scientist reader could also get. And from the feedback that the book has been receiving, it appears that I achieved those two goals. Jane Goodall wrote the foreword, in which she states it's without doubt one of the most important books of the last 50 years. And several people who have written reviews, whether they're scientists or non-scientists, have commented that the book is riveting, and some have called it a page-turner. So, and yet it is scientifically solid, as has been attested by many scientists who have read it. So it seems that I hit that sweet spot that I was aiming for.
For those who are just now joining us, this is Sophia Ray on the People Speak Radio, and we are with Stephen Drucker. Mr. Drucker, Monsanto seems to be a big part of this genetic engineering that's taking place right now, and they have approximately about 404 facilities all over the world. They are in 66 countries. How do they get away with these careless acts, and can they be brought to justice for this cover-up and this gigantic scheme that's been going on for quite too long now?
Well, the main cover-up, really, the most insidious cover-up that has allowed whatever shenanigans Monsanto has pulled to succeed, as my book points this out, the main fraud, the main deception that we should be aware of and concerned about was perpetrated by the mainstream scientific establishment. And it continues, the mainstream scientific establishment globally continues to be the key player in the perpetration of the, I'm sorry, the perpetuation of the genetic engineering venture, especially in agriculture. And my book focuses on that. The FDA's fraud is also key. It was the pivotal fraud, but it couldn't have occurred without the groundwork that had been laid by the fraud of many years, the deceptions of the mainstream scientific establishment. Several activists have complained to me that my book doesn't focus enough on Monsanto. And my answer is that's because almost everybody else is focusing on Monsanto. And Monsanto is not the main problem here. Even if Monsanto went away, there would be other corporations bringing out genetically engineered foods. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and other foundations and nonprofits that are heavily engaged in developing GMOs, that wouldn't stop them. So it's very important to understand that this is far bigger than Monsanto, and it's far more insidious and dangerous that the mainstream scientific establishment has been abusing its authority and covering up key evidence, mounting vicious attacks against scientists who have performed independent research that has demonstrated one or another harm of genetically engineered foods when tested through rigorous testing on laboratory animals, and has been basically, in many ways, not just spinning information, not just spinning the facts, but distorting the facts and deceiving the public. That story needs to be told, and that is the main story told in my book. So my book deals with far more than the FDA fraud. Monsanto is mentioned, the industry is mentioned, but the main problem is, as the book demonstrates, the corruption of science, the subversion of science. And that's why the subtitle of my book is How the Venture to Genetically Engineer Our Food Has Subverted Science, Corrupted Government, and Systematically Deceived the Public. Because the subversion of science is key. Had it not happened, the rest couldn't have happened either. And the corruption of government, clearly, Monsanto and the industry had a lot to do with that, and my book describes it. But it couldn't have happened without the deceptions of the mainstream scientific establishment. And that's a very important point to note.
In your book, I wanted to quote, here I quote, "It would be a serious health hazard to introduce a gene that codes for antibiotic resistance into the normal flora of the general population." Can you elaborate more on the importance of this quote?
Yes, and first it's important to point out that quote did not come from me. That quote came from FDA experts in the Division of Anti-Infective Drugs who have been asked to review a key feature of a majority of genetically engineered crops that have been developed. That feature is antibiotic resistance, because in order for the biotechnicians to be able to identify which cells of the plants that they have attempted to engineer actually took up the foreign gene successfully, they need to put a marker gene on most of them. And the marker gene that worked the best and was the easiest and the cheapest for the industry conferred resistance to an important antibiotic. Because if that marker gene is connected with the other genetic material that is implanted, then only the small percentage, and it's important to note, only a small percentage of the cells are successfully transformed. So only they won't be killed if the entire batch of cells is subjected to the antibiotic. So the antibiotic resistant was an important way for separating out the cells that had been successfully genetically engineered from those that hadn't. The problem is when the FDA's own experts reviewed that, they overwhelmingly concluded it was a very bad idea. And you, the quote you read is just one of the warnings that they issued that came from the, a memo of scientists. So the FDA was told in no uncertain terms by its own experts, they shouldn't do this. They should not approve the use of the antibiotic-resistant marker gene. I mean, as I think almost every listener knows, there's been an abundant overuse of antibiotics in the United States already. It's led to antibiotic-resistant bacteria, some of which are posing major health hazards. And this was back in 1992, 1993, I believe, where the FDA scientists were reviewing this proposed use of this antibiotic-resistant marker. So they strongly warned their superiors not to do it, and it's not like there weren't other alternatives. As one of the FDA scientists emphasized, there were other ways to, there were other marker systems available. It's just, he said, the antibiotic-resistant one is the pet of the industry because it's essentially going to be cheapest and save the money. But he said that benefit cannot outweigh the risk of imposing that extra burden on the population of the potential of developing antibiotic-resistant bacteria within their own gut, the gut flora of them and farmyard animals. It could be a major problem. And of course, I think everybody could have guessed what would have happened, given the kind of influence that the biotech industry has been successfully wielding at the FDA ever since its inception, and at the other federal executive agencies, administrative agencies. The FDA completely ignored the input of its own scientists and opted to go for industry convenience over public safety, abrogating its duty to protect the integrity of the food supply and the safety of the public. And then it lied. It claimed that its experts had reviewed the issue of the antibiotic-resistant marker and concluded that there was no problem, that it was safe. An outright lie. And my book describes this whole sorry episode in much greater detail. It really is one of the ugliest episodes, I think, in the history of American government. That, along with all of the other frauds, and unfortunately there have been many, that the FDA has perpetrated in order to get genetically engineered foods on the market and keep them on the market.
How do you propose, to perhaps maybe take these off of the market and bring awareness and, bring a whole boycott to annihilate the whole process? How can we get rid of the GE foods that are harming us and not benefiting us?
Well, first, I don't think we should give up hope. Many people have despaired. They think it's just too heavily entrenched. The most we could hope for, perhaps, is labeling. And maybe over time, enough consumers will read the labels and avoid the foods that it could start having some impact in the industry and dissuade them from producing these. But again, that in itself, I don't think would stop the Gates Foundation or many other foundations and institutes from pushing ahead to develop these crops. But I'm not saying people shouldn't work. I think people should work on every level. There's been a very powerful grassroots organizing movement that's occurred in the United States over the last 5 years that have alerted Americans to the fact that they've been eating genetically engineered foods, which most of them didn't know 5 years ago, and that they are on a market without labels. So there's been a big push for labeling. That's created a much more savvy public about the fact that there are genetically engineered foods, and many people are beginning to wake up to the fact that they do impose risks, food safety risks and environmental risks. Certainly they do. The FDA scientists that reviewed the issue, but way back in 1991, warned repeatedly about the unusual risks of genetic engineering and of the need for carefully testing its products. Those warnings were covered up and were only uncovered in the lawsuit that I initiated, of which you spoke in the beginning of this interview. But there are many people working on many levels, and I think it's all important, and it all can come together to have a major effect. As I discuss in the book, the last chapter, I think probably the most effective and quickest approach would be the approach that basically I'm taking the book, which is to put all of the dirty laundry together into one book, a book that can be read and accessed by intelligent people in public interest groups, in science, who have been misled by the genetic engineers, and hopefully by key officials in our government. Hopefully by the president and first lady, who are very intelligent lawyers and would immediately get the message of the book, because that, I think, would be the quickest way through, is to get sufficient number of very intelligent, influential, powerful people in our country and other countries to be apprised of the facts and to become aware of the degree to which they have been lied to by scientists in whom they had a right to trust. And that could make a very fast turnaround, very fast turnaround. So I'm focusing more on that way. Other people are focusing on whatever they think is the most effective. And I think we should all just continue. But if we all do continue with renewed dedication, I think we can have a victory far sooner than most people think.
In your last chapter, in your concluding paragraph, since you brought up your last chapter, you said something that was phenomenal. And I want to read this. It's just a couple of sentences here, and this must be from you. And I read, "The time has come to set things straight. The time has come to restore the integrity of genomes, the integrity of science, and substantiability of agriculture. The time has come to transcend the mistakes of the past and advance to a brighter and more fruitful future." There's a lot of inspiration in those words. There's a lot of hope in those words, a lot of love in those words. But do you think that is possible? Can we achieve that?
I do believe that, and I'm so so moved and appreciative that you felt the hope and the love and the passion in those words, because since they were the concluding sentences of the book, I spent quite a bit of time writing them, crafting them, so that they would have the kind of effect that obviously they have had on you, and that I think they have had on many of the readers. Just listening to it stirred me again, and I do believe it sincerely. I believe that we can move ahead, we can transcend the mistakes of the past, but of course, first we have to recognize them, and there's so much denial today within the scientific establishment and the biotech industry, so we first have to make sure that people understand what the mistakes of the past have been, so that we can learn the lessons from those mistakes and transcend those mistakes, transcend the unfortunate past, and move to a brighter and far more fruitful future. And I do believe that. I believe that the future of agriculture will be in smaller scale, a sustainable agroecological farming, especially in the third world. And in fact, that's what UN... international experts have called for, major report co-sponsored by four UN agencies and the World Bank, concluded that certainly in the developing world, the key is not genetically engineered food, not the big industrialized farms. It's small-scale agroecological farming. And increasingly, that is, I think, that kind of farming is going to be playing a bigger and bigger role here in the United States, in Canada, in the European Union as well. I believe that's the future of agriculture, and we have to really transcend genetic engineering and certainly stop it as fast as possible. My goal is to see these foods off the market as soon as possible, and all future research in them basically understood to be fruitless, because it's not going to be accepted by society. And that, I believe, can happen. And that is what I am working for. I'm aiming for something very big. But I think it's achievable. And if enough people read my book, I think it will be achievable very quick. In fact, it's feasible that by the end of this calendar year, the whole massive venture to genetically engineer our food could already have been put into its death spiral. And an agricultural economist whom I interviewed, you know, in writing the book, who wrote a very powerful review of the book, and I report this in the last chapter, he feels that actually within 2 years, after there's basically an acknowledgement that these foods have to be ended, that within 2 years, they pretty much could be out of the food supply. So that's pretty fast. And I'm hoping for that, and I'm aiming for that.
Mr. Drucker, we have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to pick your brain on an opinion of yours and get to some listener questions that's coming through to me. So we will be back in just a few moments.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Today's school libraries are filled with endless opportunities. With access to print and digital materials, the latest technologies, and the guidance of a school librarian, our children are empowered with the tools they need to succeed in school and beyond. I'm Julianne Moore. Join me in celebrating all of the ways that school libraries and librarians are transforming learning for our students. For more information on how you can become involved, visit the American Association of School Librarians at aasl.org.
This land is yours.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak, every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern, on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
And we are back on The People Speak with your hostess, Sophia Ray, and we're live with Stephen Drucker discussing GMOs. I want to quickly ask you for your opinion before I ask some listener questions. I want to know, do you think genetic engineering may have been around for quite longer than we are aware of and that might be admitted to? And do you think that perhaps this has an effect on the evolution process that is a well-thought-out coercion of social engineering for the control over behavior and thought processes of the masses?
Well, we actually, Sophia, know quite well when the genetic engineering revolution began, because we know that scientists wanted to do something like genetic engineering for years, but they just were not capable. It's not a simple thing at all. It was quite a dramatic breakthrough. I mean, at the time, it wasn't simple. And we know when that happened. It's well documented. It happened in the early 1970s. And we just know that at least if we want to refer to genetic engineering by its technical name, recombinant DNA technology, then humankind has not been able to wield that technology successfully to really develop a recombinant DNA technology until it was the early 70s. And we know who, you know, who were the first scientists who did it. We know the early history is well documented. So anything else that people are referring to as genetic engineering that might have occurred earlier is not the same thing at all. It's something else. And it's probably using traditional breeding techniques one way or the other, but using naturally available sexual reproductive pathways. And I know there are a lot of theories about, people trying to use genetic engineering for eugenics or anything. I am not aware of any solid evidence that that has been practiced in any wide scale. I think that we know that there are several other motives for developing genetic engineering the way it's along the lines that it has been developed. There could be other motives of which I'm not aware. They could have been hidden agendas, hidden conspiracies. I'm not aware of them. And frankly, I didn't think I need to spend time trying to go into it, because what we know is far, it's ugly enough. The history that actually is known is right out there and is irrefutable. The evidence that is irrefutable and is documented thoroughly in my book is all that we need to know that this, that at least certainly genetic engineering in agriculture has never been a good idea. Its risks have been covered up, and if science had been followed, and if the United States law had been followed, and if the truth had been told by the mainstream scientific establishment and by the FDA, genetically engineered foods would never have come to market in the first place. I wouldn't have had to write this book. We wouldn't be having this conversation right now. And my book really demonstrates the truth of the statement that I just made.
It really does. It truly does. And to our listeners right now, do you have questions for Mr. Drucker? If so, call in 1-888-429-5471. Mr. Drucker, I would like to go into some questions that are coming in from listeners at this moment. Let's start. We have one that is pretty intriguing here. I'm trying to pull it up here, and it's coming in pretty slow. All right, Harold in England. How easy is it for the scientific community to fool the majority of the population on topics such as GMOs or vaccines, and why is it so easy?
Well, unfortunately, on the topic of GMOs, which is what I'm an expert on, the GMO deception, it's been far too easy, unfortunately. And, scientists are well-respected, and they are perceived, especially university scientists or scientists with major institutions that are felt to be independent, supposed to be independent of industry. So when scientists who are not working directly employed by an interested industry make statements as scientists, people take it at face value. They believe that they're speaking from the basis of solid evidence, especially when they say there is no scientific reason to doubt these, or even worse, these are scientifically shown to be safe, which is malarkey. That's a huge lie. But when they speak it, people believe it, and the media report it, and it's been far too easy. That's why I focused on the fraud of the mainstream scientific establishment. And the questioner is in the UK, as I believe. My book shows in painful, actually ugly detail, how the Royal Society, the UK's Royal Society, really the oldest and in many ways most august scientific organization in the world, has sullied itself. It has, it really has lost its own integrity in its push to promote genetic engineering and to attack, and I don't use the word attack lightly, attack the scientists who have shown integrity and have tried to do independent research and have alerted the public to risks. they have been vilified, not only by the mainstream scientific establishment around the world, but one of the main leaders of the charge was the Royal Society. That's just one of the ugliest, darkest chapters in the history of science.
We have a caller on the line. Caller, state your name and where are you from?
Hi, this is Mike in California. Mr. Drucker, I've been listening very carefully. As I understand it, you're a lawyer. You've done your
Correct.
Homework. You've used legal action to obtain evidence regarding what I would consider a crime. Have you, you know, and I've been an activist for a few years, and one thing I've learned is you never get change by asking or demanding or being nice. You get it by having a subtle threat or an obvious threat behind that request. And I was wondering, with that in mind, would you be willing to sue the United States government or the corporations for this crime? And could you, you know, keep, you know, using the evidence you have, getting further expert witness testimonies from scientists who know about this and would back you up, would that be a plausible possible action that you could lead or be a part of?
Well, there have been several lawsuits, some successful, some not, on one or another aspect of GMOs, but trying to block the approval of the release of one or another crop for environmental concerns, usually. There have been attempts for major class action lawsuits against Monsanto or the industry as a whole. None of them have been overly successful, as far as I know.
I ask you, is the reason for their lack of success, is it because what you would consider a rigged game whereby the courts are not doing their part as far as being honest and forthright and allowing justice to go forward?
I really haven't had enough time to keep up with all of them to give you a good answer on that. But I think the you mentioned, you know, bringing people to justice for their crime. I do feel that when the facts are out there and enough outrage has been generated among the citizenry, and many people have reported to me that they are outraged as they read my book, and for good reason. It's outrageous what has been going on in the name of science, in the name of responsible governance, that at some point, some criminal actions will be brought against some of the key people in the government and perhaps in the scientific establishment. Well, I don't know if the scientific establishment might be tougher, but certainly there could be censure brought against some of the scientists who have really behaved the worst. But I believe that there are probably people within the FDA who might be liable to prosecution, criminal prosecution for what they've done. And that would be for somebody in the Justice Department in the future when things have changed and the federal government is no longer pushing these but is now confronting the truth and trying to clean things up and come to terms with it. That could happen. But again,
your book is a huge part in enraging people, but how does that translate into action unless it goes the route of Mark Wahlberg and the shooter where somebody actually takes a gun or blows up the Monsanto factories or shoots, you know, corporate heads of Monsanto? I don't see how that's going to translate into changing anything.
I don't think we need to go that far. As I said, and I don't know if you have my book or you may get it, but if people read the last chapter, they will see, again, I discussed it, you know, earlier before the break, but I believe there's major, major possibility for getting rapid change without translating outrage into violence. But certainly we want to be forceful. But the example that one of the main examples I give in that chapter, and I think it's quite important, is what happened in 1906 when really the very first food and drug legislation was passed, and that was a book was published called The Jungle. It exposed the horrible conditions in the stock markets, I'm sorry, in the stock yards, in the meatpacking industry, especially in Chicago, but it was going on around the nation. And it really shocked the populace. It shocked the president, Theodore Roosevelt. He dispatched a team of fact finders to make sure that the facts were as bad as the book reported, and they reported to him they were. He released a special report to Congress, and that book came out at the end of February of 1906, and before the end of June, there were two major statutes that had been passed in Congress. That's amazing. We don't even need to have new laws. All we need is the current laws to be enforced. They've been broken. So especially the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, the forerunner of which was passed by by Congress in 1906. So, and then Roosevelt needed to spur Congress to pass two new important statutes. As my book points out, we don't need new statutes. All we need is President Obama to sign an executive order telling the FDA to follow the law, to get its policy in line with the law for a change instead of violating the law. And just that, just the publicity alone would, I think, put an end to this whole GMO venture. So it's
The FDA is above the law. They're going above the law because they're not following the laws and nobody's doing anything about it.
Well, I'm saying if people, and by the way, I have been speaking over the last months with members of the Senate, members of the House. Some of them, when they actually realize how they've been lied to and hoodwinked, are starting to get concerned and wanting to learn more. And some are reading my book now. And in fact, in Iowa, just over the weekend, one of the presidential candidates, Governor O'Malley, former governor of Maryland, who met me at a function, talked with me, became concerned, became interested, wanted more information, asked for the book. He has the book. He mentioned it two different public meetings in two different cities when asked by somebody in the crowd what he thought about genetic engineering. He said he's trying to get up to speed on the issue, and he mentioned my book, that he's got my book, and he plans to use that as a resource in becoming informed. Well, that's pretty important, and who knows how that could kind of thing could mushroom if he continues to speak out and cite my book. So I'm going to go. So many other people are trying different things. I'm really working on trying to get maximum number of people informed. And certainly when I can focus on the kind of people, I'm focusing on people who have influence and could make a major change, and who have been hoodwinked and do not like the fact that they've been hoodwinked once they learn about it.
We have, you know, there's a question from Andrew in Cambridge, and he's asking, when can we expect GMO labeling of food? But I want to add to, a suggesting question from yourself, which was, what would you say to those who would be satisfied with those labels?
Well, I mentioned this point in the book, and I mentioned it when I speak. I fully understand why so many people are focused on labeling, but I cannot in good conscience advocate for labeling for one basic reason. Well, there are many reasons, but the most basic one of which, if I argue for labeling, then I'm tacitly acknowledging these foods on the market legally. Because if a food is on the market illegally, the proper remedy is not to slap a label on it. You get it off the market. Labeling is only an issue for foods that are legitimately and legally on the market. And no GMO food is in the United States. Every one of them, as we speak, is on the market illegally. I know that. I fully understand it. Therefore, as a matter of principle, I cannot argue for labeling. I want to explain to people why labeling is inappropriate in this instance. Certainly, it would be better than what we have. But I think we can get much more, which is to ban them. And I know many activists who've been involved for years in the labeling campaigns and only wanted to focus on that have been so frustrated with the defeat of the recent round of state labeling initiatives in Colorado and in the Pacific Northwest that they've told me they don't want to focus on labeling anymore. They agree with me. We should focus on getting a complete ban. Now, obviously, many people are still arguing and focusing on labeling, and I say more power to you. Whatever motivates you, get out and do it. Mm-hmm. But I can't be behind labeling. I'm focusing on a complete ban.
As we're on this topic of labeling, now, you wrote in your book about the differences of here in the UK. The UK actually is more open about genetic engineering and what products are on the shelf and such. Why not here?
Well, by the way, it's not just the UK, it's the entire EU, and it's most every other industrialized nation has instituted requirements that genetically engineered foods be labeled. Why not here? And I must say, why not in our northern neighbor, Canada? We're glaring exceptions. I think it's well known that the United States government has come under the influence of industry very, very powerfully. And industry did not want labeling. And they were strong enough to keep it from happening in the United States. But it's not, again, it's not just the industry. It's also the influence of the scientific establishment. In fact, during a very critical final part of the campaign to get a ballot initiative passed in 2012 in California that would have required mandatory labeling in that state, the American Association for the Advancement of Science released a statement from its board of directors stating not only that labeling was not necessary, but that it was a bad idea and it would, for several reasons. And they also stated that there's an overwhelming consensus that these foods are safe. That's not true. That every respected organization that has examined the issue has concluded that genetically engineered foods are as safe as other foods. That's a flat-out falsehood. And so, again, it's not just, but that statement coming at a very key time in the campaign, a few weeks before the voters went to the polls, that had a major effect, I'm sure. And in fact, the margin of defeat of that initiative for labeling was less than 1%. And I am almost sure that there were at least 1% of the California voters who were convinced by that statement by the American Association for the Advancement of Science, one of the world's most prestigious scientific organizations, to shift their vote, to say, well, if they're saying that it isn't needed and it's actually a bad idea, that labeling is actually a bad thing, then I don't want to be on the opposite side of science. And they shifted their vote. I'm almost sure that if that statement hadn't come out, the ballot proposition would have carried. It would have won. So it's not just the industry. It's an unholy alliance of the mainstream scientific establishment and industry. And boy, industry alone is powerful. The scientific establishment alone is powerful. You put them together, they have been almost invincible when it comes to getting their way with genetic engineering. And it's a very, very dangerous development. And that's why I think people have to know about it so that we can basically stand up and get that stopped, get science brought back into line. And there really many of these scientists and scientific institutions should be publicly shamed for the role they've played in the irresponsible behavior that they have exhibited.
It is a very risky game that is imposed by a psychopathic corporate governance that has flooded out a democratic government. And how it happened, I don't know. And why it happened is obviously not for a very good reason. And it's leading us to a downhill, and it's not seeming like a very good outcome. How can we put out the message? How can we disclose this, expose this, and correct this? That's what's really important is bringing the awareness, because it's through the awareness that we can actually turn this around.
I agree with you. And again, most activists are still confused about some of the key facts of genetic engineering because of all of the disinformation that's been dispensed. Many activists feel that we meaning those of us who are opposed for one or another reason to this massive GE food venture, that we are too weak to fight it on scientific grounds. And they've ceded the scientific high ground. That's why a large number of the organizations that are fighting for labeling have essentially tacitly or explicitly conceded that there are no legitimate food safety concerns. That's really wrong, because there are. There always have been. And there have been numerous scientists who have raised food safety concerns, including the scientists at the FDA. So I think it's a very defeatist attitude to think, well, we can't win on the science. Let's just argue right to know. That hasn't been very successful so far. What could be successful is to, use the evidence in my book showing that these foods are unreasonably risky, that they definitely haven't been demonstrated safe, and that the evidence as a whole demonstrates that there are solid grounds to view them with concern, and that several of them probably are risky, that there's more than enough evidence to have demonstrated that several of the genetically engineered foods on the market are risky and should not be on the market at all. And the evidence as a whole also raises doubt about the safety of every one of them. That is solid science. Many scientists agree with that position, and we need to understand what the truth is, because far too many activists have been confused, and they think that they are weaker than they have to be. So I hope more people read the book and become strengthened.
I don't want to cut you off, but I have another question for you, and that's coming in from Anonymous in Canada, and they want to know, do you think Monsanto executives eat their own GMO-grown foods?
I'm sorry, do they eat their own? Not if they know what's good for them. I just don't know. But the thought is, even if the Monsanto executives are able to buy only non-GMO food for their families, and I really doubt they all are, but let's say a few of them are, they can't prevent their children from getting exposed. Their kids are going to
birthday parties.
Their kids are buying junk food in stores on their own. So again, their kids are being exposed. I don't see how they could insulate their kids from being exposed.
This is a very important topic. We don't have enough time. Where can our listeners find your book? Do you have a website you want to give our listeners?
Sure. First, it's available in many bookstores. It's also available on Amazon, and you can download a very big free sample where you can read Jane Goodall's foreword, my introduction, the entire first chapter, and most of the second chapter for free. There's a website, alteredgenestwistedtruth.com. Also, the website of the Alliance for Biointegrity, biointegrity.org, biointegrity.org. Contains quite a lot of useful information and copies of 24 of the key documents that were pried out of the FDA files by the Alliance for Biointegrity lawsuit. So that's interesting reading. So
go ahead.
The book
quickly,
is.
Quickly, do you just have any last message that you want to leave our listeners with?
Don't give up hope. Get the facts, start telling other people, and do whatever you feel moved to do. If you want to fight for labeling, go for it. If you want to do something else, go for it. The main thing is get active. Don't think that you can't have an effect. You can have a much bigger effect than you realize. And the people you talk to, they have influence, and you'll create ripples, and the ripples coalesce into major waves. So don't despair. Get informed and get active.
Mr. Drucker, you are a great man. You have a great message. I appreciate your work. I appreciate you here with us on the People Speak. I would like to keep in contact with you and see where this goes. But right now, this is the most saddest part of the show where I have to say this is the end. And join us next Tuesday with guest speaker Rabbi Brent Rawson. I want to give a big thank you to all of our listeners, to our guest, Mr. Drucker, and a huge thank you to our engineer, Doug Newsom. Let us unite through love and light. Be good to one another, and good night.
One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of the steeple, by the relief of us, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.